Thanks everyone for coming. I know a few people are still coming in the back. We've got plenty of seats up here, so go ahead and make yourself comfortable. Thank you for coming to my presentation. How many people were in my last talk earlier this afternoon? Okay. So I'll rehash a few of the things that I said earlier. I'll probably make a few of the same jokes, just, you know, everyone should get to hear them, right? And so for this particular session, I am going to be talking specifically about some of the new software testing capabilities that we have within Visual Studio 2010. Now, on the printed agenda, I noticed that the audience type for this was software testers. And of course, software testers are kind of the primary focus for this presentation, but I also think that as software developers or project managers or team leads, there's something in this session for everybody, because let's face it, first of all, everybody kind of has a vested interest in making sure that we build high-quality software, but also there's a lot of interaction today that needs to happen with the testing team, and what I find is that there are these walls in place in between software testers and software developers and customers and the rest of the team and so on and so forth. And so a lot of what we've done within Visual Studio 2010 is to try and tear down those walls and help enable testers to do their job better as testers, but also to better interact with the rest of the team. So even if you're not a software tester, I hope there's something in here for everyone. And on that topic, out of curiosity, how many people do consider their full-time job software testing? Okay. So I'm glad I said that, because the rest of you, either this is something that you can take back and show your testing teams how to benefit from, or this is at least something that you can start to look forward to as your testing teams adopt in terms of how this might be able to benefit you within your organization. So for those of you who weren't in my last talk, I get to say who I am. So my name's Brian Keller. I'm a technical evangelist for what used to be called Visual Studio Team System. The marketing team likes to change things every few years, so now we are Visual Studio Application Lifecycle Management, whatever. Okay, it's kind of the same thing, right? I work in Redmond, so I flew over to South Africa last week and got to talk to their Dev Days audience. This is my second week of Dev Days, and I've got two more weeks after this. So it's really an exciting time for us to be able to get out and talk about what it is that I work on, which is, of course, Visual Studio 2010. I also am on Channel 9, so if you are looking for another video podcast to add to your RSS feed, you might want to pick up This Week on Channel 9. As I noticed right before I went on for my last presentation, I'm wearing the same shirt today, so that's really embarrassing. I mentioned I've been on the road for 2 weeks, so there's not a lot of options in my suitcase right now. I also maintain a blog, and the reason that I'm plugging my blog is that everything I'm going to show you, I think everything, at least 90% of what I'll show you, I made sure that before I left Redmond, I shipped it all up as a VHD, so you can actually download the exact same virtual machine that I'm running. It's available within Hyper-V, within Virtual PC 2007, within Windows Virtual PC, so you can download everything along with 9 scripted hands-on labs that you can use to actually go through pretty much everything that I'm going to be talking to you today about. I'll also make sure that all my slides go up on my blog in addition to the Dev Days website, and I've got another presentation medium based on Deep Zoom that I'll be showing here in a moment, and that's all available off of my website as well. So don't feel like you have to take a lot of notes. This session's being video recorded. I also should mention that I'd love to make this an interactive session. When they gave me 2 time slots for, this is actually a 2-part session, the next part is tomorrow morning. When they gave me 2 time slots, I didn't realize that this was going to be a 75-minute session. So we do, for once, have the luxury of time to be able to dive off into discussions or answer questions, anything you might have. Likewise, if you were in my earlier talk and you have a question that's still lingering from something I showed within the rest of the application lifecycle management capabilities, that's all fair play. So we can definitely talk about that. And I recently completed my first book with a few other co-authors. This is all about the application lifecycle management capabilities of Visual Studio 2010. So if you're so inclined, it's about an 800-page book. It's designed to cover everything from getting started with Team Foundation Server to everything I'm going to talk to you today about manual testing to the architecture tools. So it's really designed to be kind of that reference manual. I really don't make any money on it, so I don't care if you buy my book or another book. There's a lot of great books out there, but I say this just to make you aware of one resource that will be available. I don't know when it hits Europe, but I know in the States it'll be available next week. So this is the part of the presentation where I tell you why software testing is important and show you a bunch of numbers. And of course, you know, we all know some of these things. I'm sorry, these are U.S. numbers. I couldn't find anything that really sums it up for Europe, but I'm sure you guys have similar problems to us with respect to software testing problems. In the U.S., software bugs cost the economy an estimated $60 billion. That's a lot of money in my book. Here's another statistic I really like. On average, professional coders make 100 to 150 errors in every 1,000 lines of code that they write. And you know that's only 10 or 15%, but as we know, just an error in a single line of code can have disastrous outcomes. I was actually meeting a couple days yesterday with one of the largest medical providers out here, and I definitely wouldn't want to be in their shoes when they start to encounter bugs, because that can be a life or death scenario. I have another customer that was one of the largest social networking websites in the United States for several years, and they like to write quality software, but at the end of the day, they said, well, what's the worst thing that can happen? Someone might lose a friend, right? And so, you know, at different ends of the spectrum, you might care about different software quality levels, at different rates, but at the end of the day, this is something that we're all held accountable for in terms of the software projects we put together. So let's talk a little bit more about some concrete examples. The USS Yorktown, this is a smart ship, which I don't know if I wouldn't ever call something a smart ship. That's kind of asking for trouble, just because you know something's going to go wrong. I think that this introduced something like 20-some-odd Pentium 200 megahertz computers, and it was dead in the water when someone entered a zero in one of the text boxes on one of the data entry panels, and that generated a divide by zero, and of course shut the entire ship down for several hours. Had to be towed back, actually. Of course, I'm going to pick on Europe. So this is the Ariane 5. I think a lot of you probably know about this problem, divide overflow, that ended up causing the rocket to basically think that it should be headed in a different direction. $370 million US at 1996 prices. I wouldn't want to be on the receiving end of that phone call. And then this one actually has a happy ending. This is the F-22 Raptor, and once they crossed the international dateline, the computers went haywire. They lost all communication, but luckily they had good weather, and they were able to follow a smooth flight path back to Hawaii. And if you like these types of examples, there's a really great presentation called The History of Failure that was presented at OSCON a few years ago. And one of the things I liked about that is they actually attempted to quantify the value of a human life. And I think it was something like $3.2 million if you divided the number of people into the total GDP and multiplied by their lifespan. And then he proceeded to look at examples where a single person, you know, writing a bad line of code, for example, was able to not only eradicate the entire value of their own life, but was able to eradicate the entire value of hundreds, if not thousands, of other people's lives due to one stupid mistake like this. So my goal for this session is to make sure that none of us in this room show up in a future history of failure presentation. So hopefully we're all on the same page there. Of course, you know, we live in a glass house, so I'm throwing some stones here. We can pick on some of the products that we ship here. Following application should be closed. Not sure I want to close that one. This is still copying. I love this one. I'm sure none of you have ever written any code that's generated anything close to this, you know. And then, of course, okay. Not much choice there. So before I delve into demos, actually, I want to talk about Microsoft's approach to how we see our role in terms of helping to fix this problem, at least as it's scoped to Visual Studio 2010. So I'm a rock climber. I live in Seattle. There's a really great, you know, selection of mountains and glaciers and stuff for me to climb. So I kind of like to think about software applications and software quality the same way that I think about my training circuit when I'm getting ready to climb a mountain or do a glacier hike or something like that. You know, you start out in the gym and you spend day after day working on your strength and working on skills. And if something goes wrong in the gym, you might, you know, fall from a few feet. You might jam a finger. At the end of the day, the cost of failure in that scenario is not very high. You maybe take a day off from the gym, you go back, and everything's great. But by the time you get on top of the mountain and you've summited your first glacier climb, as I was doing here, this is called El Dorado Glacier. It's in the North Cascades. Beautiful climb. And then it's kind of hard to see in here, but behind me is a hailstorm that's moving in. And this is my first climb, so I didn't know any better. I didn't have my rain gear on. Shortly after this, before the hailstorm hit, we actually took our crampons off, and we're hanging out up there and starting to make our way down. And then, boom, we get hit by this 60-mile-an-hour hailstorm. And I'll tell you, that's when you want to make sure that you've ironed out all the bugs in your system. You want to make sure that you're physically fit to make it down the mountain. You want to make sure your first aid skills are at the top of their game. All your gear works. Everyone back in your hometown knows where you're at, and you filed a trip report and everything else like that. So if you think about the way we develop software, we kind of have the same type of process here. You know, if you are able to catch a bug when you're developing the software and you're able to remember, okay, that's because I just added a line of code 5 minutes ago. Let me go back and look at that line of code. That might be a 20-minute fix. It's not going to cost you or your company very much to actually fix that. But as you start to get through the phases of release and you send something out to the customer and the customer calls you up and says, hey, that line of code that you forgot to fix just crashed a rocket or just killed a patient that's on you know, one of their operating beds, then you start to have serious consequences. And so, you know, obviously we want to do things to help you drive that quality back closer to the point of origin, closer to the developer who's writing that line of code. And if the developer can't fix it or the developer can't catch it, then we want to make sure we at least catch it within the test cycle before that goes out to release. So, makes sense, right? Not a lot of rocket science here to figure out that's one way to solve this problem. So, we took a look at testing across the entire life cycle, and we said, okay, this is software testing as a whole. And on the far right-hand side, you have software developers who are writing code. Within Microsoft, we would call these SDETs, software developer engineers writing test software. So you're writing software that tests other software. And so here you're writing unit tests, maybe you're writing load tests, you're writing specialized performance profiling algorithms to go through and make sure your application is running at maximal speed. You're writing lots of code to test other code and hopefully to automate those things and catch regressions immediately or at least that night when your nightly build kicks off. And then at the far left end of the spectrum, you have the old school manual tester walking to a room. It has maybe a list of Word documents that contain their test cases or maybe Excel spreadsheets, and they're manually sitting there and they're hammering away at the keyboard and they're moving their mouse and they're clicking and they're filing bug reports and they're telling you how your software is behaving. And I actually was surprised once we got the data back that said that the majority of software testing today is still focused on manual testing. In fact, 70% of the testing activity that takes place across companies of all different sizes is manual testing. And you think about the fact that the majority of the offerings that are out there, both in the open source community as well as from vendors, actually target the right end of the spectrum. And you start to wonder, well, why is it that 70% of the testing that takes place is still manual testing? And at the root of the cause here, the real reason for this is because our applications are always changing. You know, you can go out and invest in UI automation work, but if you then turn around and change the UI or change the way that the sign-in logic works or change the way that, you know, you calculate sales tax and something ends up breaking your tests, then you just have to throw away all that test work because now you have to rewrite that set of automated tests. Whereas with manual tests, you have an actual human who's able to say, you know what, I know I'm supposed to sign into the web application. It doesn't matter what the step says to do. I know that last week we changed the way the sign-in works, and so I'm going to apply my, you know, human brain to the problem and figure out that I need to sign in a different way. So they go in, the test remains robust, and they're able to maybe even catch things that are not that are kind of outside the beaten path for what a unit test might be looking for or what a regression test might be looking for. And so I think that this trend is going to continue. We're going to continue to have manual testing be a very, very important part of the software development lifecycle. And so Microsoft wanted to do something to help these testers since really there hasn't been a lot of work done to elevate them from the point of using Word documents or Notepad or Excel to track all their test cases and then kind of rudimentarily file their bugs over to the dev team. So that's where we're targeting. And of course, another problem that we've noticed, I'm sure this hasn't ever happened to you, but sometimes at Microsoft, someone finds a bug and goes to a developer and says, you know, hey, I found this bug, and the developer turns around and says, well, you know, works on my machine, right? Like I said, I know none of you have ever done that, but our software testing friends who are in the room can probably tell stories. And so what are the reasons for this? Well, one of the reasons is that the developers might be running a different build, or might be running a different spec of hardware, or might be understanding the way that the software is supposed to work differently than the way that the tester is actually testing the software. There's any number of different mismatches that can happen that occur between the tester and the developer, which can result in the tester finding a legitimate bug, and the developer either not believing them or not being able to reproduce the bug. And even if they are able to reproduce the bug, do they have all the information they need in order to ultimately, of course, fix the bug? I got to spend a few hours yesterday with Scott Guthrie, and Scott was visiting some customers, and I was along with him. And the question came up of, you know, how do you think about productivity across your team? How do you think about making your team more productive? And you know, we all love the demos of Visual Studio, where you can, you know, right click and generate code, or the fact that add new references is now asynchronous in 2010, so it populates, you know, that much faster, so it saves you 10 seconds every time you add a new reference. And don't get me wrong, I love that stuff. That's great. That can help me crank out code. I feel like a ninja. You know, it's good stuff, right? But if you really stop and think about where are you spending the bulk of your time, think about a simple bug. Let's say that you find a bug and you come to me and say, you know, I found a bug, we have that conversation, and I go back and I try and reproduce it on my machine, I shoot you an email, well, maybe that takes 15 minutes for you to reply to, and then you've got to type up another email, maybe you're in a different time zone. I mean, if you think about all the different costs of exchanging that information back and forth, every sort of latency hop that you have is going to contribute to a loss of productivity. It doesn't matter how fast we make Visual Studio. In the end, we really need to focus on bringing people together and making sure that the work that happens from one person can easily transition to the other person. So now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to drop into a series of demos that are going to be aided by what I've created here, which is a SpeakFlow. And SpeakFlow is basically a nonlinear way of presenting a different set of concepts to you. So we can kind of jump all over the place. You can find this on my blog as well. I have a bunch of videos in here. I won't be showing the videos, but if you wanted to go back and show your colleagues some of these tools, pretty much everything I'm going to show you is actually backed up by videos as well. So you could kind of go through this at your own pace just by following the link on my blog. And so if we start with the tester workflow, one of the first things that software testers do, of course, is they put together a test plan. And that test plan is usually aligned with a development plan as well. So if I'm planning iteration 2 of my software development project, and I'm going to add the capability for customers to pay with PayPal and a credit card during checkout, then I should probably have that accounted for during my test plan. And so the test plan might lag behind the development plan by a couple of weeks, or whatever the case may be, so that we can wait for the development team to get to the place that they've actually implemented some functionality before we start testing it. But in the end, what we're looking at is making sure that the test plan actually aligns with what the developers are building. Go figure. Novel concept, I know. And so within that test plan, we should start to take into consideration things like, well, what environments are we going to test on? Well, what does marketing tell us our product needs to be sold on? Maybe it's supported on Windows 7 and Windows Vista, but we've made the decision we're no longer going to support IE6. Okay, well, that's good. That's probably something we need to take into account for our test plan. What information is going to be useful for a developer when we find a bug? And we've got some pretty novel approaches, I think, to the way that we collect that information and send it back to the developer. What tests are we going to run? In what order do we want to run the tests? How do those tests link back to the individual requirements? All these things get captured in the test plan. Test settings is where we start to define what information gets captured while we execute our tests. And so going back to the scenario earlier, you know, I might be running on a 32-bit machine, and my tester might be running on a 64-bit machine. Well, wouldn't it be nice to know that when I start getting bugs from my tester? Or maybe the tester was testing Friday's build, and everything I'm doing is on Monday's build. That would be a useful information to have. Maybe there's some information in the event viewer. How many times have you gotten a bug from a tester and said, hey, can you go check out the event viewer? And so you have to wait for the tester to go to the event viewer and you know, maybe attach that and send it back to you. So that's time lost. But wouldn't it be nice if we could start to collect this information automatically? And then there's this IntelliTrace thing that I'll talk about a little bit later too. And so within what I'm about to show you with Microsoft Test Manager, we allow you to automatically define that on this particular machine, we want to capture system information. And maybe the test also interacts with a back-end SQL Server database, and we want to have the event viewer turned on because maybe there are some event logs that we need to see might be causing the problem that a tester might find. And so this all gets captured as part of the test plan as well. And then finally, we have this concept called test configurations. And test configurations allow you to define which operating systems we're going to test on, which browsers we're going to test on. You can really define any type of configuration you want in here. Maybe you even have one application which is dependent on an internal set of libraries, and across your company you might have different versions of those libraries on different machines. Well, maybe you want to have that represented as a test configuration, so you test to make sure that it works on last year's version as well as this year's version. Any number of things you can represent in there. So I promised you a demo. Let's go ahead and drop into my virtual machine here and show you how we pull together test plans. This is my sample application. We'll be getting to that later. We have a new product called Microsoft Test Manager. And Microsoft Test Manager was built from the ground up with a software tester in mind. So we didn't want to have to go to software testers and say, in order to play in this brave new world of testing within the Visual Studio 2010 family, go install this 3-4 gigabyte product and figure out this 747 cockpit and you're on your own and let us know when you find a bug. We built this from the ground up specifically for software testers, and throughout the rest of my presentation today and tomorrow, my hope is that you'll become familiar with this enough so that you can go back to your own organizations and set this up and start running your test plans with it. And so if we take a look at the top here, we basically divide this up into two different activity centers. And so we have the lab center, I'll be talking about that more in depth tomorrow, as well as the testing center. And for the most part, these are the two tabs that a tester is going to live on. So it's the planning tab, usually the software testing lead would actually put together the software test plans. And then the test tab is where a tester comes in the morning and says, okay, what do I have to test today? And so starting with the test plan, we have properties here. And if you look across the top, we have a bunch of metadata for this. And so we're going to call this test plan iteration 2. And again, that's probably going to map back to a development iteration as well. And so if we look at the description I've given this, we're focusing on site fit and finish work and security hardening. So at this point, we've probably met with the development lead and said, hey, what are you guys building for this release or for this iteration? And they say, here are the things we're focusing on. Okay, those are the things we're going to go test. This information at the top is really just metadata. It doesn't get used for anything else, including the start and end date, so you can pretty much ignore that for the rest of the purposes here. What really gets interesting down here is when we start taking a look at things like test settings, builds, and configurations. So starting with test settings, if we create a new test setting, this is where we define what data gets captured when I'm running my tests. And so I can call this dev days. Give it a description. We need the event viewer and video recorder. Manual or automated tests. I'll be showing more about the automated tests tomorrow, mostly today focusing on manual tests. Roles is where you define which machines make up your environment. So for this particular demonstration, I'm running my web server, my database server, and my web browser all off one local machine. But you could imagine a scenario where you've got all three of those components running on different machines, and this is where you define that, okay, on the web server, I actually care about capturing IntelliTrace, and on the database server, I care about capturing the event viewer, and on the local machine, maybe I want to capture video. Data and diagnostics, this is where I can start enabling and disabling what actually gets captured during my test runs. So actions, you'll see me talk about those later. The ASP.NET client proxy for IntelliTrace and test impact, I'll introduce those concepts later, but just remember that this is required if you're going to be doing IntelliTrace or test impact analysis from an ASP.NET application. And of course, that needs to be run on the web server tier. So in the event that you've got multiple machines, this needs to be collected from the web server. Event log. So let's go ahead and turn on event log and go to configure. And you'll see that some of these actually have additional details that I can turn on and off as well. So here, which events do I want to collect? Which events types do I want to collect? So maybe it's interesting for me to have success audits as well. So I'll go ahead and turn that on and say okay. We're also mindful of the amount of space we take up, because as you can imagine, as you start running all your test runs and you start filing bugs, we want to make sure that we don't completely fill up your TFS server. And so one of the things you'll see on a lot of these data diagnostic adapters is the ability to turn up and down the amount of data that we collect. Network emulation, well, IntelliTrace I'll get to later. Network emulation, the collectors that you turn on and off on this page don't have to collect any data. They can also impact the machine under test. So in this case, we ship a network emulation adapter that allows you to say, I want you to pretend that the web server is operating at 56K, or maybe we connect to a remote database backend. So I want you to pretend that any connections to that backend SQL server are actually coming across a 128K LAN. So you can turn this up and down and then apply different settings to different components within your test environment. System information, that's going to basically just give me a kind of an MS-DIAG look or a sysinfo look at exactly what's running on the machine. You'll get to see what this looks like later. Test impact I'll talk about, and then of course video recorder as well. When I mention video recorder, everyone starts to panic. They say, our TFS server is going to fall over. This is way too much video. Videos are historically very large. We're actually using some Microsoft Research technology in here to make sure that the screen captures that we do are pretty small. In the future, we'll be coming out with a power tool as well that can help you go back and prune old data out of your TFS server, like maybe iteration 2. We want to get rid of all the attachments to the bugs. But the actual video that gets captured is very, very small. I think it's about 1 meg per minute. Just depends on how much activity you have going on the screen. So we can turn video recordings on and off. We'll go ahead and cancel out of this because I already have my test settings set up the way I want them. But this is pretty easy to configure. Now, the next thing I'll show you is test configuration. So this is where you would define which operating systems or compatibility with certain libraries you want to test against. I can manage configuration variables to say, all right, I'm interested in pivoting my test plan based on the operating system or based on the browser. And here you can enumerate the list of operating systems and browsers that you're going to test against. And then you can also toggle this on and off for individual tests. So for example, maybe for some of your tests, you're testing JavaScript functionality, and it's important to make sure that the test behaves well on both Firefox and Internet Explorer. But for some of the tests, you know that the browser really has no bearing on it. Maybe it's all back-end tests that you're running. And so for particular tests, you may want to say, we'll just test with this with Internet Explorer, and we don't care whether or not, or we care whether or not it works in Firefox, but we're not going to explicitly test within Firefox. And then lastly, we have builds as well. So here's where I link up to my Team Foundation build definition. And this is where I'm able to define what builds am I actually testing. And this is pretty important as well, as you'll see later, because all of my tests, all my test runs actually get filed against a build by default. And as we start taking a look at the reporting as it comes across my various test plan iterations, then this is important for us to be able to track our test runs over time. Now, a test plan may not pick up every single build. You might say, okay, we're going to look at every Friday's build and determine whether or not we want to inherit that into our test plan. But you can at least say, all right, this is the build definition we're keyed in, and then you can even define a build quality as well. So you can say that we're only going to look at builds that there's been some scouting work on to say that, yes, this is worth our time, that this is something that does actually install, and we want to turn our testing efforts onto that. And I'll show you later on exactly how we help you determine which build you want to test with. And so that's test plans. And so that's kind of configuring it at a high level. Now, the next thing, of course, it wouldn't be a very interesting test plan if we didn't actually test anything. And so now we need to start thinking about authoring our tests and organizing those into what are called test suites. So we give you the ability to author test cases within Microsoft Test Manager. Those get stored within Team Foundation Server, and those get stored within TFS as work items. If you were in my first presentation, you saw that in TFS 2010, we now support this really rich work item hierarchy system that allows you to relate user stories or requirements back to the individual tasks that the developers are performing to implement those requirements. Or another good example would be to relate test cases back to those requirements as well, so that you can start to take a look at dashboards and reports that show you, for this given requirement, it's 80% done, and 50% of the tests have been written, and then 2 out of 3 of those tests that have been written are actually passing. And you can start to really get this rich data. So TFS is going to be required if you want to take advantage of what I'm showing you here. The other thing I will say about that is a lot of people say, oh, well, we don't use TFS, we can't set that up. We've done a lot of work in TFS 2010. In fact, during my last session, I pulled someone up out of the audience, said, hey, set up TFS Basic. He had never set up TFS before, and he clicked through, and within 10 minutes, we had a TFS server that was up and running. So I would say that if you looked at TFS in the past and you're kind of scared at everything that goes into TFS, please give us a second chance. We've done a lot of work there to make sure that it's easy to set up. And if you have Visual Studio 2010 with an MSDN subscription, you actually get a TFS server license and client license with your MSDN subscription. So we're trying to give it away, trying to get it out there so that you can adopt what we're doing here. But getting back to authoring and organizing test cases, we allow you to author those test cases, to organize them into suites, and then to link those back to the requirements so you can start to light up some of those reports. The other thing we allow you to do is create what are called shared steps as well. So imagine a scenario where you have the same repetitive task that happens over and over again throughout all of your different test steps. A good example might be log into the web application, or create a user account, or add, you know, a box of tissue paper to your shopping cart before you check out. You know, any number of things that might be very repetitive. What you can do is you can actually group together test steps as shared steps, and then if something changes, like maybe you change your login information to support Passport, then you can update that in one location, and then that will cascade throughout the rest of your test cases as well. And you don't have to go through all 100 test cases and make those changes. So I'll show you how that works. By the way, if you guys have questions while we go, as I mentioned, we've got a little bit more time given the 75-minute session. Yeah, Luke. So the question is, when you're setting up your test plan, are you allowed to share it with an external party? Now, are you looking to share the process of testing, or are you looking to share the results of that test plan? Sure.
They can add some thoughts on it.
Yes, absolutely. And we actually have a power tool. I haven't played with it yet, but the idea of the power tool that we just shipped is that you can do just that. You can generate, I'm pretty sure the output is either Microsoft Word or Microsoft Excel documents, but you can then say, hey, here's the test plan. Let's go share this with the customer and make sure that what we're testing is what they expect the software will behave as. So yes, excellent question. Anybody else? Okay, let's write some test cases. So here what you see on the left-hand side is a list of my test suites. And there's 3 different types of test suites. 7, 8, and 9 here, those are actually work items that are represented as user stories within TFS. You can change this if you want. You can make it requirements. You can make it widgets. It doesn't really matter. We just have to have something to then hang your test cases off of. And what you see here is if I open up the requirement is just a basic work item within TFS. I can edit it from here. I can make any changes. I can see exactly what maybe it's the business analyst or the project manager had in mind when they authored this requirement. And so as I go through here and add test cases to my test plan, to my test suite, which is represented by the requirement, those test cases, if I now open this up, now have a link back to that user story. So this is hierarchical work item relationships at work for you. So the other 2 types of test cases that we can have, or rather test suites that we can have, are either query-based test suites. And so you might have a query that you write to say that, you know, for iteration 1, we had all these test cases that were really high high importance. And so you can assign a priority on those test cases, and you can say that even though we already shipped all that functionality with iteration one, we want to make sure that we continue to test that as part of this test plan. And so you can create a query that says, bring in all those work items that have high priority, or rather those test cases that have high priority, and then those show up and are reflected within your iteration two test plan as well. And then you can just have this kind of freeform test suite, which is where you drop anything you want into it. So these might be ad hoc test cases that you create that don't necessarily have a requirement that they stand behind, but maybe it's make sure the help about button still works, or make sure that the copyright still displays a certain date. Some of these things you may not get to the point of actually documenting as requirements within your application, but you might find that those are things that are nice to actually track as part of your test plan. And so for my test case, I'm just going to create a new one with an end-to-end test. I should probably link it back to a requirement, but we'll skip that for now. And we'll start typing. So I'm going to save you from having to watch me type. Take the title here. And so for this particular test case, we want to confirm that after we go through and place an order with our e-commerce site, that there's a receipt that shows up. And so what I've done here is I've pasted the individual test steps into my test case. And test steps, it's pretty straightforward, right? It tells the tester exactly what to do. No rocket science here. But what makes this a little bit unique from, say, an Excel spreadsheet or a Word document is that, first of all, we create what are called test parameters. And so if we wanted to have the tester run this multiple times, but with different data each time, then one option is to rewrite the test case three different times. But the other thing we can do is we can actually parameterize this test case. And so parameterizing a test case is as easy as using the ampersand sign, creating the name of the variable, and then what you can see down here at the bottom is that we've created multiple columns that say first, last, email, address, city, and so on. And so now what I can do is I can take the data that goes into those parameter values, and I can paste that down there. And now we have three different rows within my parameters, and so that's going to be represented as three different iterations that we need to run through this test case. The other thing that that is a little bit different about a Word document or an Excel spreadsheet is that we have the notion of a verification step. And so what I have over on the right-hand side is that there's this expected result. And by marking a test case or a test step as having an expected result, we're basically telling the tester, before you actually close out this test case, you have to tell us whether or not this step passed or failed. Now, as a tester, as you'll see in a moment, I have the option of marking any number of test steps as passed or failed. Maybe something that's not even a validation step fails. You know, step two could fail, and I might want to say that fails so that the developer knows that I didn't even get down to checking out the receipt. I actually couldn't even sign into the web application. But at a minimum, we want to make sure that if we're validating that the receipt appears as part of this checkout, then of course we need to tell the tester, and this at this particular step, you need to mark it as pass or fail. And so at this point, you know, I could link this back to a user story. I could add some attachments. I can even add an attachment for like a screenshot. So for example, maybe I want to show the tester that when you're on the checkout page, this is what a receipt looks like. This is what you can expect to see. You can add any number of attachments to actually help the tester, and you can actually add those attachments on an individual test step as well. But for this test case, I'm done. I'll go ahead and save that. And now that's going to show up in my test plan underneath end-to-end tests. And so at this point, I'm actually done authoring the test case. The other thing that I could do if I wanted to is I could open this up and say, you know what? Going to this website and clicking model airplanes and clicking Northwind Trader, you know, some of this stuff I'm going to do over and over and over again. And so if I wanted to, I could come in here and select multiple steps, right-click and say create a shared step. And then that could be the shared step of open website and add item to cart. And then that gets saved somewhere else, and then that actually becomes a separate test case work item that you can then consume and reference from other locations. So now let's talk about actually running those test cases. So you're a tester, you come in the morning, you've got this list of test cases that that you need to run, and so you're going to open up what's called the Microsoft Test Runner, and Microsoft Test Runner is going to take you through a list of all the individual test steps that you need in order to perform that test. And so, as you'll see in a minute, we give you a nice little window that says, okay, now you need to open this website, now you need to go to this URL, now you need to go to this add item to cart, and so on and so forth. But in the background, one of the things that we're doing is we're actually collecting all of those test settings as well. And so a lot of times I see this knee-jerk reaction within a developer and tester collaboration scenario where, the development team's gotten tired of not getting enough information from the tester, and the test team's gotten tired of having all these bugs come back as no repro. So together, their managers say, all right, every time you file a bug, you need to fill out this 10-page report. And this 10-page report needs to have a screenshot that you paste into Microsoft Word, and it needs to say what machine you're running on, and it needs to say what time of day you tested on, and what build you're running on, and blah, 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 blah. And so now, as you're testing your applications, are you really going to bother to fill out a bug every time you find one? No? Probably not. I have to fill out that stupid 10-page report. And so what we're trying to do is we're trying to make this all automatic so that as you're running your tests, this all gets sucked right up into the bug report. The other thing that we can do, too, to kind of take the monotony out of some of the software testers' lives is to automate some of these steps as well. So one of the things that we do while you're running your test cases is we can actually capture action recordings. And an action recording is your interaction with everything that happens with the software application under test. And so I clicked this button, I typed this information into this text box, I opened up Internet Explorer, I went to this web location, anything that you can think might be captured there, we can actually capture via these action recordings. Now, it doesn't work for every application type. I actually have a slide in here which I'll make available. If I don't show it at the end of my talk, I'll make that available on the Dev Days website. We do support web applications with Ajax. We support Windows Forms, WPF. Eventually, we'll support Silverlight 4. We have a prototype of that working right now. What else? We support most Win32 applications. So it depends on the application type that you're testing to our ability to actually capture these action recordings. But as long as you're testing one of those supported application types, or 6 months down the road, 12 months down the road, either us or a partner has come out with the extensibility pack to support the application type that you're testing, then you can actually take advantage of the fact that we'll capture everything that you're doing, we'll include that information in the test results, and then you can also use that to take advantage of fast forward for manual testing, where you automatically play back a list of steps. And as you'll see in a minute, it can really increase the speed at which you can run your test cases. So we've authored our test case. I'm going to come over to the test tab. And now, once again, I'm a tester, and I'm putting on my hat to say, all right, what do I need to do today? What are the tests that I need to run? And for those of you in the front row, you may have noticed that over on the left-hand side, we have user story 7, 8, and then my test suite of end-to-end tests. What happened to number 9? Well, if we go back to number 9 was actually set to in planning. And so you can see I can set the state over here to in planning. I could also set it to completed. Either one of those states is going to prevent the test case from actually showing up on the tester's radar because maybe we haven't implemented the test, or maybe we've got to a point of confidence within testing the application that we feel pretty good. We feel that we don't have to test this anymore. You know what? Help about works. Ship it. So if we come over to testing again and look at the test we just wrote, here you can see that I have one iteration of this test run. And this might be backed by actual multiple iterations based on test parameters, but at this point I only have one configuration, meaning I only need to test this under Internet Explorer and Windows Server 2008. If we wanted to, we could have come back over here and said for this test case, we want to assign a unique configuration pattern to say we also need you to test that on Windows 7. And if I do that and apply changes and come back to test, then now you see it actually shows up twice. And so that means that I need to test it multiple times, of course. But I'm just going to test it under Windows Server. That's the operating system I'm running. I could say run. I'll say run with options to just to show you what your options are. At this point, I get to decide what test settings I want to use. And this is actually an important thing to point out. The test settings that I showed earlier had a number of different configurable options, everything from system information to event viewer to video recording to these IntelliTrace things that I keep promising I'll talk about. And everything that you turn on there will have a certain degree of overhead associated with it, either in terms of performance when we're actually running those test cases, or in terms of storage space when you store the results of those test cases or when you file a bug. And so you probably don't want to turn on everything all the time. You might want to say that for 90% of the testing that I do, I'm just going to record the system information and the action recordings and the event viewer. And you might save this as a lightweight diagnostic run. And then if you find a bug, or if the developer comes back to you and says, yeah, it looks like you might have a bug, but it would be really helpful to have, you know, a video recording or some other artifact, then you can actually come in here and toggle this and say, you know, actually, I do want to run with full diagnostics. So just something to keep in mind as you start thinking about the information you want to collect. So we'll go ahead and run this test case. This is going to launch the Microsoft Test Runner. I'm going to close out of my other applications. And we'll go ahead and create an action recording. So we're going to capture all the actions that I perform as I interact with this application. Now, an important thing to point out about that, let's say that you're testing your application and you know, you're doing a great job, and all of a sudden you get an IM from your boss, and he says, hey, you want to go grab drinks after work? You probably don't want that information captured as part of the test results, right? And so one of the things that you can do back on the test settings is you can actually define which application types you don't want to capture. And so by default, we capture things, or we exclude things like MSN Messenger, Communicator, but you might want to have your own protocols in that list. You might want to have certain applications that you don't want to capture for security or privacy reasons and add those to the list. So just something to think about as you start running through your tests. So I'm going to start my test, capture an action recording, and we'll go ahead and launch my web application. For those of you in the front row, notice there's two actions that are captured down here. I'm going to go ahead and paste that. And I don't know if you saw that, but momentarily that actually jumped up to 5. Because what I was doing is I was clicking within the address bar, and then I was fumbling around, and I was trying to paste my address into that URL field. And what happened was it said, you know what? I actually am going to throw out some of those actions. I understand that what he's really trying to do is go to this web application. And I'm not going to zoom because I don't want to interfere with my recording, but what it says is that I started testing, I opened up a blank website, and then I went to this URL. And so that's pretty important. We do a lot of work behind the scenes to try and make sure that we collapse those actions where we understand what your intent was. The other thing that I could have done is notice that I have that Tailspin Toys icon at the top of my browser. I could have clicked on that just to launch the web application. But the problem that that might introduce is that later on, when I went to actually run this test on another machine, and I wanted to take advantage of some of the automation capabilities that we have to do either fast forward for manual testing, or as I'll show later, fully automated coded UI tests, and my other tester's machine doesn't have this button, it's not going to be able to find it, it's not going to be able to resolve. So you want to be careful about things like that that are going to make your tests more brittle. And as you start moving through this, you'll start to pick up things like that. But I would say always make sure that, at least in the beginning, that you're capturing your tests and then you're playing them back on maybe your friend's machine to make sure that everything works over there as well before you tell the rest of the team to go ahead and fully automate this test. So I went to the website. I'm going to go ahead and pass that. I'm going to click on model airplanes now. Pass that as well. Northwind Trader. Looks like an awesome plane. Cool. Pass that. Add that to my cart. Check out. Now let me stop right there because you're probably thinking this is a pretty laborious way of actually running my test. And the reason that I'm clicking on every single test case, or test step rather, and saying pass, fail, is because I'm capturing that action recording and I want to correlate exactly what I'm doing back to the individual test steps. Now, if I was just running through my test case and I didn't care about capturing an action recording and I just wanted to see, does this work, I don't have to report on pass, fail for each individual test step. But as you'll see later, this becomes really important because if I wanted to, say, playback part of these test steps and not other test steps, then I'm going to need to make sure that the action recordings correlate back to the individual test steps that I'm running. So now I'm down to the fun part, and that is I need to fill out all of this data into this form. So now watch this. Control paste, control paste, control paste. OK. Kind of cool, huh? What's next? Country. So I just needed to select that. Washington. Select that. Control paste, and I'm done. And what you can see over the left-hand side, I'm sorry for those of you in the back, what it's done is it's actually marked yellow data binding icons for each one of the fields. And so what it did is it said, okay, I know you're ready for this value. Let's go ahead and paste this into this cell. And then when I changed focus away from that cell and clicked in the next cell, it said, okay, we know that Michael goes into the first name text box. We know that Affronti goes into the last name. I could also go back and click on one of the hyperlinks to put it back into my clipboard. So for example, if I had a password and a confirm password, and I needed that same value to go in both, then I can do that, and it would actually bind to both text boxes. That's not a problem. Pass that. Click on review order. And place order. And now it's telling me I need to confirm that the order page has the receipt. Sure enough, there's the receipt. So that's great. We'll pass that, and now we'll close the browser. Now I'm going to end the iteration and go to the next iteration. So remember, I had three rows of data within my test case. And so now we're done testing for Michael Affronti. Maybe we want to test for another customer as well. I'm not going to overwrite the existing action recording. Yes? I'm sorry, does the test runner have a what? Oh, so does the test runner, can you make it smaller so that if you have full screen apps, you can make it a little bit smaller. I could collapse the width, but height-wise, you can't collapse it. But what you can do is you can dock this on another monitor. So if any of the managers in the room, you need to go buy extra monitors, right? But we do support multiple monitors, so you could actually have this on another monitor. So the other thing I could do here is, like, let's say that the application changed and my action recording is no good. All I need to do is actually click this box, and I can re-record a new action recording, and then that would overwrite the old one. We want to make it really easy because we understand that your software is going to change as you go throughout the course of your day. So anytime a tester runs this, they always have the option of re-recording that action recording. So we'll go ahead and start that test. And now what I'll do is I can multi-select a few of these fields. Click on play, hands off the mouse and keyboard. So we think that we're about 20 times faster than the fastest manual tester out there. And if you find someone who's faster, we want to hire them. So now it's basically said, okay, we're not going to make the manual tester go through all those first 9 manual tests. That's mind-numbing. That's boring. We want to make sure the manual tester is doing what they do best, which is using their brain to look at the application and make sure that it's functioning and behaving correctly. So if we scroll over to the right, there we go. We've got that receipt number. We'll go ahead and pass that. And just for grins, I'll go ahead and play that final step. It's going to close the browser. Yeah, there we go. And so now that iteration is finished. We'll go ahead and end that one. And if I wanted to, I could run that third iteration. Now, if I found a bug at any point along the way, I could easily come in here and file a bug. So let's say that I want to create a bug. Let's say also maybe I wanted to capture a screenshot. So we'll say capture a rectangular screenshot that shows what's going on. You know, I'll just say maybe I didn't like the fact that the recycle bin was there. I don't know. I'm just making stuff up, right? But at this point, what I could do is I could say, go ahead and create a bug. And this is going to launch, create a new bug wizard. And you can see right here, all of my test steps are represented in here. If I show you an existing test case, and I'm just kind of fast-forwarding in the interest of time, but if I show you an existing test case over here that's been filed, you can see the types of artifacts that we can start to collect off of that. So if I come to my bugs. I've got an existing one in here. You can see that we have a video, and so in the background, we're actually capturing, if you enable the proper test setting, we're actually capturing everything that the tester did, and so now we don't have to have this guessing game back and forth between the developer and the tester, and are you sure you clicked on the right link, and are you sure you're using IE and not Firefox, and yada, yada, yada. We can actually have videos that show up within here, and these can be correlated to the individual test steps as well. So rather than just open up this video as an attachment and have to fast forward, and figure out where the problem happened, we can see that when the tester marked this test step as failed, it was actually at 36 seconds. And so when we launched the video, and I'm not going to do it because my video driver under this VM is terrible, but take my word, when you launch this video, we actually rewind a few seconds and we show you exactly what happened when the tester marked that test step as failed. If we scroll down, we get other information in here. We get system information, so that actually shows up enumerated like this. So you can see I was running Windows Server 2008. I had Service Pack 2. Here's my language packs, and so on and so forth. I can even have multiple machines represented. So here you can see multiple machines that were part of my test plan. And I can see which test case I was testing, and all this information automatically gets captured. So at this point, the developer hopefully has everything they need to understand that, yes, we have a problem. I can see exactly what's going on with the problem. And then, oh, by the way, let me go fix that problem as well. So we've talked about actionable bugs. Now let me talk about some of the stuff that we do to help you figure out which builds you want to run. So as I mentioned earlier, a test team is rarely going to pick up every single build that a development team cranks out. It just probably wouldn't be worth the time. They've got to take that build, they've got to set that up, they've got to stop any of the testing that they're currently doing, move all that testing to a new plan. And so a tester will usually go through the process of, as I mentioned earlier, scouting a build to say, okay, is this worth our time? Is this something that installs? Is it something that maybe the development team do enough work to actually implement new changes that are different from Friday's build that make it worth me picking up? And answering those questions can take a lot of time. You may have to go talk to the build engineer to say, hey, did the unit tests on last night's build pass? Is that worth our time actually, you know, testing this from a manual test cycle, because that's really expensive to do? Maybe you want to go talk to all the developers to say, what did you actually change, or did you fix that bug that I filed? And so because everything flows through TFS, we can start to answer those questions for you and help the test team figure out exactly which builds they want to pick up. We also have this really cool new feature called Test Impact Analysis. And so for any of your .NET code that you're testing, we can run Test Impact Analysis behind the scenes to determine which methods were executed when you were running your tests. Okay, so if you're familiar with code coverage works very similarly. So when you're running through your tests, you can say which lines were actually impacted, and that can give you kind of a gut feel for, am I actually testing all of my software, or are there huge chunks of code that aren't being tested? That's code coverage. Test impact analysis behaves similarly, because what it does, it says, okay, when I went through the exercise of adding an item to my cart, and checking out, and paying for it, and having that get shipped, these five classes got executed during that whole process, and actually within those five classes, it was these three methods in this class, and these two methods in this class, and so on. And so what we can start to answer in the future then is, if a developer changes this one method that relates to the way that we calculate sales tax, we can then reverse engineer that to say which test cases were actually reliant on that particular method. And so when a tester gets in the morning and they've got this daunting list of 100 different test cases that they need to run because we just picked a new build, we can at least help them focus on the areas that are most likely to require their testing. And so these 5 out of 100 test cases are things that you should look at because we changed methods which are dependent upon, which are dependent on by the test that you just run or just ran. And then the other thing we can help you do is help you go through and say, okay, based on what the development team is telling us, they think that these 10 bugs are fixed, and so now we need to go back and verify those bugs to make sure that they're actually fixed. So let me show you how that looks within the VM. So now I'm a test lead, or I'm scouting the build, and I'm trying to figure out, okay, which build do I want to pick up? And so right now, you can see that I've got this build up here. It's .3 is the build in use. That's what I've been testing against maybe for the last week. And I see that there's a number of new builds that are available. We've got this .4. Well, what's different about .4? Let's assume that it installs. Let's assume that it passes all the unit tests. What's actually different about this .4? And so what we can do is we can come down here and say, all right, this is the list of work items that were changed in this build. And so you can see that someone, they did some work to check in a regular expression. Okay, well, you know, that's interesting, but that's really not a whole lot of work, so maybe this isn't worth me picking up. All right, let's take a look at .5. .5, okay, they did some additional work. They added that regex to the website. That closed out a requirement. Maybe that was actually blocking my test runs earlier, so I want to now pick up this build and run it. But then there's this newest build, .6, and I can see that they also fixed this bug. So, okay, I've been waiting for that bug fix. This is great. This is promising. Let's pick up this build. So now I'll go ahead and assign this build to my plan. And now it's telling me I can view recommended tests. So this is all based on that test impact analysis. So based on the last time I ran these test cases, which test cases do we think still need to be run or need to be run again? So let me view recommended tests. Now it's going to come back and tell me the last time I ran these test cases, they passed. But now I've actually made changes within my source control, which say that I maybe want to consider rerunning these test cases again. And so if I agree, then I can select these test cases. I can right-click and I can say reset to active. And what that's going to do is it's going to signal back under my testing tab that these test cases need to be run again. And so now my test team has all the signals they need in order to go out and rerun those test cases. Okay? Now, if you stop and think about test impact analysis, you might be saying, all right, well, that's great, but there's a lot of different things that might change within my application which could cause tests that were working last week to fail now. And you would be right. And so I would caution you to say, look, this is not a panacea. This is not going to tell you that only these test cases that passed last week are going to potentially fail, and it's not going to say that anything that wasn't impacted by code changes is necessarily going to pass. Because maybe there's changes in the backend database. Maybe there's changes on other things that introduce new dependencies that weren't picked up by last week's test impact analysis run. And so don't use this as the holy grail. But again, as you start thinking about, we have limited time, we have limited resources, where are we going to put our testing efforts? This is one tool that you can use to help decide how to do that. That's a great question, and I think we have time to show you exactly how that works. So the question was, can you rerun all your test cases automatically? So at this point, what we can do is we can launch those test cases, and we can say run them, and if we've recorded action recordings, then we can hit play, and we can watch everything go through. Now, that still requires someone sitting at the machine. It still requires someone to say, yeah, you know, that receipt showed up, or no, it didn't, or you know, maybe some crazy image went missing, and so we need to file a different kind of bug. So over time, you might get to a point where you say, you know what, we want to fully automate this test. We want to make this part of the daily build process so that when we run our builds, this automatically gets captured as part of the regression testing that we do, and we're adding validation logic to say, is that receipt there? And so that is where the developer comes in and takes a look at the existing test cases that you've been running manually and decides which ones, if any, you might want to turn into fully automated tests. So let's do that now. I have a test in here that's test case number 41. And number 41, if we open this up, this is something that is going to make sure that the user can't enter invalid information into the shopping cart. You know, what's the classic hack? You can enter a negative number into your shopping cart, and now instead of, you know, paying for an item, you're getting money back into your credit card. Not that I've ever tried that, of course, but you know, wouldn't that be nice? And so we want to make sure that our web application isn't doing things like that. We want to also make sure that it doesn't support, you know, zero, because what does that mean? And maybe it shouldn't support the letter A as well, because that really doesn't mean anything. So we've got this test case to capture that. And my manual test team has run through this a number of times, and it seems to be passing. And at this point, let's go ahead and fully automate it, because we're pretty sure that this particular section of the website is probably not going to change a whole lot between now and when we ship the application. So I make note of the fact that this is test case number 41. And now I'm going to drop into Visual Studio. Let me just make sure this is all set. Yep. And so in Visual Studio, I'll say File, New Project. and we want a test project. So this is the same type of project you would create if you were creating a web performance test or a unit test. In fact, it gives me a unit test by default. I don't need that. We'll close that out. And I'm going to add a coded UI test. And a coded UI test is our fancy name for a UI automation test, basically. And so now I get this prompt that says, how do you want to create this coded UI test? We have two options. One is you can either open up the application, run through it like you would as a user or however you want to test the application. We'll record and capture everything that you're doing as you interact with the application. We'll codify that, and then you can come back and add assertions within code or using the same process. I'm going to show you a mix of using the existing action recording to do the same thing. So when I ran the test runner earlier, I captured all my actions within that individual test case. And then I can take those actions, pump those into code, and then I can add an assertion in code as well. So we use an existing action recording. We're going to point back to our test case. And that was test ID number 41. There it is. Looks great. Now what it's doing is it's taking all those actions that were captured earlier, and it's turning those into code. And tomorrow I'll show you this in a little bit more depth. But if you see here, what happened... Let me zoom a different way. What happened was it took all those test steps from the test case and it turned those into method calls. And if we go to definition, like I said, I'll spend more time on this tomorrow, but if we go to definition, we can see this is the actual code that represents how we're interacting with that application, and I can make changes to it if I want. But by default, I don't have to. The designer generated everything for me. If I wanted to run this application now, it would go through and it would click through my application and it would close the browser and everybody would be happy. The problem with that, though, is of course we still need to add what the manual tester was doing, which is some sort of visual validation that the application is still behaving correctly. And so the way we can do that is we can come to the test step that conforms to where we're validating. And so right here is where the tester, manual tester, would make sure that after you change the quantity and click on the white space somewhere else in the application, that it refreshes and the quantity goes back to 1. And so now what I do is I say test, generate code for coded UI test. I'm going to use the coded UI test builder. And I'm going to put my application into a state where I want to actually validate from. And so we'll go to model airplanes. Let me just remember which one I'm adding. Fourth coffee flyer. Apparently I need another coffee today. Fourth coffee flyer. Add that to the cart. And so now we have quantity of 1 right now. And so this is the pristine state. So what I want to happen in my test case is if I change this to the letter A, for example, it should go back to 1. So we want to make sure that we validate this. And the way we can do that is we can take this crosshair down here. So this is our test builder. Take this crosshair, drag and drop it down to the control. You've all seen this before, nothing fancy. And so that says this is the text box that we want to validate. We also have this little D-pad here, so that's useful in case you have like a hidden control, like maybe it's a panel that holds other text boxes, and you can't select the panel because the panel's not enabled or it's not visible. So you select the text box in there, and you browse up in the control hierarchy, and then boom, you found your panel. And so now I can add any number of assertions here, and I want to add an assertion to the default text, or actually to the text, I'm sorry. Add that assertion, we'll say it has to equal 1, say OK, and now we will generate that code. Quantity must equal 1, great, add and generate. Now that's put the data back into my VS project. Just cleaning out my shopping cart here. That shouldn't be crashing. And as you can see, we found a bug. I don't know what. Let's reset that. Yes? I'm sorry, I couldn't hear that. One more time? handle the web application? Delays in the web application. Yes. So by default, our test runner is going to. Hold on, I'm sorry. I don't know what's going on there. Let me cycle the app pool here. By default, our test runner is going to record those delays, and it's going to play it back without regard to those delays. If we wanted to, we could go back into the test settings, and we could say we actually want you to honor those delays. And so when I'm interacting with my web application, I want it to actually honor the fact that there's a delay introduced in the application. I can hand tweak those if I wanted to. I can add a standard deviation. I can do anything I want in terms of actually playing that back. But by default, it's going to play everything back as fast as it can, which means that as soon as a control appears that we're looking for, it's going to interact with that control using the next test step. So I don't know what's going on. Everything was running too smoothly, so we had to have some kind of crash. Let's try this again. Think happy thoughts. Okay, nothing in my cart. All right, cool. It worked. So now at this point, what I can do is I can right-click to run this test. And hands off the mouse and keyboard. So it's launching IE. And it's going through three iterations. Remember, we had 0, A, negative 5. So it's testing each iteration. If I was to update that test case later and add or subtract from the list of parameters, it would add and subtract the number of iterations that it runs with this coded UI test. I could also decide to go ahead and data bind this back to a SQL Server database or back to a comma-separated value list. So if I didn't want to track this within the test case, I could track it separately. And as you can see here, everything passed. If something failed, it would say what the expected result was, and it's just the exact same as you're used to from your unit testing framework. And so now, I won't do it in the interest of time, but the only other thing left for me to do would be to take this test case, upload it to Team Foundation Server, and then I can associate that with the individual DLL that I just created here and say that when you are running your nightly builds or your daily builds and you want to validate that this test case performs correctly, we now have an automated test case. And then when you run that test case, if it passes, report that to the test plan. If it fails, report that to the test plan. So I'm going to go ahead and wrap up here because I have another session tomorrow morning where I'll be showing you the rest of this, including a new capability called lab management. So I hope to see a lot of you there, and I will also stick around. So thank you very much, and see you tomorrow morning.